June 27, 1976, Athens, Greece. A routine flight from the Israeli coastal city of Tel Aviv to Paris. On board were 248 people, passengers and crew members. Air France Flight 139 had just taken off from a stopover in the Greek capital, where it had picked up 58 new passengers, including four who had no intention of flying to Paris. The armed terrorists hijacked the plane and rerouted to the little-known city of Entebbe in the middle of Africa. Their demands are to free 40 Palestinian militants imprisoned in Israel and 13 other prisoners in exchange for the lives of the hostages.
The terrorists send us a message. They'll start to execute passengers one by one.
As time is running out, a daring plan is launched from thousands of miles away. Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations. I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special operations missions to learn about the brave soldiers who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted men, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
I would say that the whole scum of the world concentrated in this place. To kill someone is relatively simple. To rescue someone is much more complicated.
As told by the people who were there.
Every few hours they say that they are going to kill us.
The only thing was to keep quiet and to hope and to pray.
The raid on Entebbe, I think it'll stand as one of the most bold special force operations in modern history.
In this episode, we look at the story of how Israel's elite special forces unit were tasked with saving hundreds of innocent lives deep in unknown territory. Entebbe, Hostage Rescue, Part 1. Sarah Davidson was a passenger aboard that flight, thinking more about her destination than her present circumstances.
I was putting nail polish on my nails, and we were talking to the girl sitting in front of us, and we found out that her parents are a good friend of us, and she was alone, and she said she's flying to meet her new husband that is waiting for her in Paris. So we just had a nice conversation, and that's it. I didn't suspect anything.
But Sarah's pleasant conversation was brought to an abrupt end as people around her began to scream. The plane's captain, Michael Bakos, overheard the commotion and asked his chief engineer to investigate. Upon opening the cabin door, he came face to face with a man armed with a revolver and a hand grenade. That man was Wilfried Böse, a left-wing extremist and part of a group that had spent years terrorizing West Germany with bombings, assassinations, and hijackings. Böse pushed the co-pilot out of the way and picked up the plane's radio. Over the PA, he announced that he was in control and that from now on, the plane was to be known as Haifa 1, taking its name from a city in northern Israel. Along with Böse was another German and two Palestinians. 750 miles away in Jerusalem, Defense Minister Shimon Peres was in a routine cabinet meeting when a messenger ran in.
He came in and handed me a very small piece of information that said that an Air France plane was hijacked, that in the plane they estimate are 234 passengers, over 100 are Jewish, and the rest are others. The question was immediately, what should we do?
The hijacking of Flight 139 was just the latest in a string of terrorist attacks targeting Israeli citizens. 4 years earlier, in 1972, 11 Israeli athletes were killed in an attack on their compound at the Munich Olympics. In the same year, 26 passengers were shot and killed while waiting for their luggage in Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. And in 1974, terrorists sieged a high school in northern Israel, killing 22 people, most of them young students. And now, this plane hijacking. Israeli special forces were put on high alert. Authorities expected the plane to arrive back in Tel Aviv, but the hijackers had a different plan. One of them was a trained pilot. He instructed the captain to divert the flight to Libya in northern Africa. Nili Ben-Dor was another passenger on board. She remembers Wilfried Böse.
Some of the Israeli men at the beginning tried to make conversation with the German terrorist. He was very communicative, polite in his way, and he described to them that he learned how to fly an airplane for 1 year so that nobody will cheat him on the way, and he knew exactly how to fly an airplane.
Following Bouza's orders, Captain Bakos flew the plane to Benghazi, Libya. But this wasn't their final destination, merely a refueling stop for a longer trip. So I was at the drugstore the other day, and really, what is the deal with razors? Do they have precious metals in them? I mean, are they mining this stuff on the moon? Why are they so expensive? The founders of Harry's asked the same question, and then they did something about it. They started their own company, selling razors directly over the internet. They even bought a factory in Germany that's been making some of the highest quality blades in the world for over 95 years. So what's that mean? You get a great shave for way less than drugstore razors. And of course, they have a quality guarantee. If you don't love it, just let Harry's know within 30 days, and they'll give you a free refund. Look, they understand that switching razors can be a big decision for some of us, so they've got a great trial offer. You can claim yours by going to harrys.com/covert. You'll get a free trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Listeners of Covert can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/covert. But you also have to check out all of their other great products on their site. They've got a moisturizer with SPF that I love, and it smells really nice. And it has SPF. Make sure you go to harrys.com covert to redeem your offer, and let them know that I sent you to help support the show. While they were on the ground, one desperate passenger, Patricia Martell, told the hijackers she was having a miscarriage, and they agreed to release her. Not only was the miscarriage a fake, Martell wasn't even pregnant, but the young nurse was a good actor. Once off the plane, Martell was immediately met by Israeli intelligence officers. She told them there were four terrorists armed with guns and grenades. Meanwhile, after 7 hours on the ground, the plane took off once more.
The plane continued to fly, and we didn't know to which destination.
In the early hours of June 28th, the passengers felt the plane begin to descend. Outside the windows, they saw rolling hills covered in thick vegetation and a patchwork of mud paths and roads. Then a vast expanse of water appeared. Lake Victoria, the world's second largest freshwater lake. They were in Uganda, Africa. Moments later, the plane landed in Entebbe, a town bordering the lake. Once a British garrison stronghold, Entebbe sits almost 1,200 meters above sea level. On the ground, the passengers received some welcome news.
When we landed in Uganda, they told us that we are released. Everybody in the airplane was very happy. We were sure that we are free to go.
But as soon as they got off the plane, all hopes were dashed.
We went down and then we saw that lots of Ugandan soldiers are waiting for us there. And six more terrorists were waiting for us there. They led us to an old terminal, which was open. Very, very old, with lots of mosquitoes, a deserted place, and they told us that we are going to stay there. We had a big room, and later they brought us mattresses and blankets, and they told us that we are going to stay there.
Suddenly, the door to the terminal opened, and several armed guards marched in. The passengers looked up to see a heavily built man emblazoned in military paraphernalia, Uganda's leader, Idi Amin. Amin was known as an unpredictable and ruthless dictator, responsible for massacring or torturing over 300,000 of his own people. Amin told the hostages that he was offering his services as a mediator in this crisis. It was unclear what there was to mediate. The hijackers still hadn't issued any demands. The passengers, unsure of their fate, spent a nervous night in Entebbe Airport. The next morning, the hijackers placed two piles of passports on the table and began to call people's names.
The German young man said they are going to separate part of us to the other room and it will be more comfort for all of us. It sounds reasonable. And they start calling the names by the passports. And after 2-3 names, we found out that it's not just, passing people from one side to the other, but it's Israeli names, Jewish names. And the more he called the names, we found out that it's only Israelis.
The group quickly realized what the terrorists were really doing.
We saw that there are two piles of passports. Later we knew that they were divided by nationality. And they told us to sit down, to be quiet, and they started to call us by names. After the first few names, we understood that they are calling the Jewish people, the Israeli people and the Jewish people. And they broke the wall between our room to another room, and they told us to pass to the other room. It was a very frightening moment, and all of us who were called, we were told to go to the other room, and we went to the other room, waiting for our destiny to know what will happen there.
In Jerusalem, the leaders anxiously followed the news reports from Entebbe as the terrorists finally announced their demands. A $5 million ransom and the release of 53 Palestinian and pro-Palestinian militants who were imprisoned in Israel. Amos Eran was the senior advisor to the Israeli government at the time.
The terrorists sent us a message that if they are not going to get an answer in the next 12 hours or 10 hours, they'll start to execute passengers one by one on an hourly basis.
Israel had had a long-standing policy not to give in to terrorist demands, but they weren't going to leave the passengers out to dry. Perez knew he needed to put a plan in motion.
I was used to the things, and usually there were several principles that I have behaved accordingly. One, to be at the place if I can, not just to give orders from far away. Secondly, not to surrender. Thirdly, surprise. Don't think in accordance with the usual thinking.
Perez turned to the Israeli Defense Forces, one of the best trained armies in the world. The IDF's elite special forces units are also world-renowned for their daring operations. Ethan Cohen was a seasoned Israeli special forces fighter.
Israeli special forces is the best. Few reasons for that. It's first time we full of experience. Second reason, it's we working by values, moral, and we defending. We're not looking for combats, which means we're here to defend on this land, on our nation. And the second reason, we working by a lot of moral and values. We think before we acting, we think on all the elements we need to handle with them in the combat. I just can tell you people in counterterrorism in Israel, in counterterrorism unit in Israel, very skilled guys working from the heart, not from the pockets, working because they need to protect on this land, like I said before, and we think everything around before we acting. This is the situation, this is give us to give the solution, the right solution for the situation in 100%, let's say, perfect results.
But Uganda was 2,000 miles away from Israel. Covert operations, a lot of planning, hard work, and overcoming obstacles. You know what that's not like at all? Stamps.com. Total opposite. They make buying and printing real U.S. postage fast, convenient, and obstacle-free. With Stamps.com, it's like having a post office right on your desk. All of the same services, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you can use it for any letter or package. We've been using Stamps.com here at the studio, and our office manager is thrilled. It just works. I mean, what's better than that? They even sent us a digital scale, so instead of just guessing like we used to do, we actually weigh it and print the exact amount of postage every time. That's smart. And right now, my listeners can use the code COVERT for this special offer, a 4-week trial including postage and a digital scale. It's the one I told you about. This is a great offer. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in COVERT. That's Stamps.com. Enter COVERT. Staging a rescue mission so far from home and under such a tight deadline seemed impossible. The Israeli leaders were trying to devise a response, but they desperately needed more time.
I thought we have a chance, with a little bit of daring, or much daring, and decisiveness, and surprise, and ingenuity to do the job. The fact, I thought in my heart, that it is a long way out, far from Israel, maybe is a disadvantage to us, but also a disadvantage to them. They are not in contact.
An operation would be extremely risky. The intelligence was minimal. They didn't know exactly how many terrorists were involved or whether they were coordinating with the Ugandan army. If Idi Amin was working with the kidnappers, the Israelis could end up facing thousands of fighters in hostile and unfamiliar territory. But Defense Minister Peres was still pushing for a plan.
The first I called in was the commander of the Air Force, who I like very much. He was a daring, non-conventional guy. Asked him, what are the forces you need to conquer Uganda? What are the forces you need to conquer Entebbe? They says, look, we have to look at the map, it's 400,000 kilometers. We have to check where are the radar stations. How can we land? How we can take over? Do we have enough fuel to fly back? Because it's a long way. And if you should be stuck with the lack of fuel again, what is the purpose?
Joshua Shaney, one of Israel's top pilots, got an urgent phone call.
The commander of the Air Force called me. I was very surprised. It's very unusual to get a direct call from the commander of the Air Force, especially in a wedding. I didn't even know how he found out about the wedding and my telephone number, but he did. And what he wanted to know is very basic information about the range, about the payload that we can take, about the fuel needed, about the route that it's possible or not to do, about obstacles or enemy around, I mean, basic stuff. Luckily, once the hijack happened on Sunday, we did do some homework in the squadron, and I prepared the questions. So I gave him one by one everything he needed to know, and then he said, come back to the headquarters, we'll start planning.
The planning group started to work through their options.
We thought that to fly with one of our tankers, which is air refueling C-130, and to drop the commando, the SEALs, the Navy SEALs, into the Victoria Lake with rubber boats. Their job was to sneak into the terminal and free the hostages, free them in Uganda, because there's no airplane on the ground. So assuming that Idi Amin, as a leader of a country, would let them go. During the week, we realized that it's not good, because Idi Amin was fully cooperating with the terrorists there.
The prime minister sent them back to work. They needed to find a better plan. Risks of a failed operation started to sink in. Meanwhile, the families of the hostages didn't wait for a daring rescue. They begged the Israeli government to give in to the terrorists' demands.
For me personally, the most difficult part of the whole today we can call it episode in a sense, but all that operation was my confrontation with the families. I can understand their concerns that they will not see anymore their husbands and wives and fathers and relatives and so on. But I didn't expect them to be so giving up immediately, saying basically, we don't want to hear about any negotiations. We want you to meet all the terrorist demands without any negotiations and make sure that our relatives are on their way home.
They decided to ask Idi Amin for his help one more time.
Somebody came with an idea that an Israeli guy that was in the military before, that was stationed in Uganda in the past, headed Israeli defense mission in Uganda, and was in close touch at that time with Idi Amin. Maybe his contacts are still relevant and he can talk to Idi Amin directly. And he said, Field Marshal Idi Amin, Dada, you remember you told me once that your mother told you to help the people of Jerusalem. And that's your chance. And those people that are being kept in your terminal are your guests. And we hope that you are taking good care of them. And if something will happen to them, that will be your responsibility. I'm not threatening you in any way, but I'm trying to be helpful to you. If you will not take good care of them, you might pay a price for it. So better do everything that you can to help them. So he said, Colonel, he used to call him Colonel. He said, yes, I know. And I made sure that they will get mattresses, water, and my soldiers are with them all the time.
These negotiations bought them some time, but the Israelis knew better than to trust Amin completely. And so, the only option was to mount a daring military raid. Guys, you've heard me talk about Hims, the one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and sexual wellness for men. So have you checked out for Hims.com yet? Have you seen that all of their products are backed by real science and established medical practice? Or do you think the random supplements they sell at convenience stores really work? I'm sorry, but what are those? Seriously. Look, the fact is, today, baldness is optional. But the longer you wait to take action, the less you can do about it. Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. And the time saved. I don't know about you, but I hate going to the doctor. I mean, for all sorts of reasons, but it always takes hours. Instead, you can go to forhims.com and answer a few questions. A doctor reviews it and prescribes well-known generic equivalents to brand-name prescriptions, not snake oil. So go order now. Covert listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See their website for full details. This would cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy. Go to forhims.com/ops. That's forhims.com/ops. forhims.com/ops. On Wednesday, the hijackers released several non-Israeli hostages and allowed them to fly back to Paris. That was the terrorists' first mistake.
We sent a team to Paris to interview them, to find out as much as we can details of what is taking place at the terminal. And we got an important information from them.
This intel was a critical breakthrough. The released passengers provided information about the number of terrorists, how the Ugandan troops were helping them, and the exact location of the remaining hostages. With this new intelligence, the odds of success started to improve. Still missing from the plan was a critical piece of information, an accurate map of the terminal.
We asked somebody from that was at that time in Kenya, not an Israeli, to try to fly above the airport by a small plane. and try to take pictures where exactly the Air France plane is parked and as much as information he could get from that. And he was able to do that and transfer those photos to us. Although it came in through the end, it was quite delayed, but we got that information. So altogether, we had quite a clear idea where the hostages are being kept, what is the logistics of the airport, where can a plane land, where is exactly the commercial runway of the airport.
Then, only hours before the executions were due to begin in Entebbe, the hijackers agreed to extend the deadline. Sayeret Matkal, the secretive Israeli counter-terrorism team, had been put on high alert since the crisis began. They were ready to pounce at a moment's notice. They have reportedly been involved in carrying out the most daring and audacious missions, including the destruction of a nuclear reactor in Syria, and many more. At Army headquarters in Tel Aviv, the team finally had a plan shaping up to be the best option. Secretly land the Sayeret Matkal unit in Uganda and storm the terminal under cover of darkness. But they still didn't know how to get past the Ugandan army surrounding the hostages. And to make matters worse, journalists from around the world had descended on Entebbe and were recording live on the ground. If a rescue operation went wrong, it would be seen by millions, while giving future hijackers incentive to repeat similar crimes against Israeli citizens. The Israelis continued planning, carefully scanning the news footage for useful information. They watched on TV as Idi Amin arrived at the airport in his Mercedes. The dictator breezed past security without being checked, followed closely by a convoy of heavily armed guards in trucks. In fact, they'd seen him make similar visits several times now. It gave the team an idea. What if they could buy the same model Mercedes and dress Israeli special ops fighters to look like Ugandan soldiers? The hijackers' new deadline was approaching fast. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin alone had the responsibility of giving the green light to such a bizarre and dangerous plan. 5 days into the crisis, Prime Minister Rabin, himself a former general, was finally persuaded by Peres to go through with the plan. It was a nearly impossible operation, but it was the best option they had. 29 Sayeret Matkal fighters would travel to Uganda, dressed up as local army soldiers, and enter the airport in a Mercedes and convoy similar to Idi Amin's. As soon as the operation kicked off, 200 hand-picked infantry and paratroopers would arrive, via 3 Hercules planes, to help take control of the airport. Amir Ofer remembers the moment he was called at home, tasked with taking on the perilous mission.
I was 22. I finished my military service. We were sent home and we were supposed to return all our gear and within a week. We were told that we have to come back immediately. To me, it was obvious why they're calling us. I mean, because we knew about this developing situation. And it was very frightening. It was a very frightening phone call, I must admit.
The assault teams had less than 24 hours to prepare and find some way to appear like Ugandan soldiers.
It was a very short briefing. I mean, Yoni Netanyahu, which was our commander, explained that there is an operation to rescue the hostages from Entebbe Airport, that we have a very short time to prepare the operation. Therefore, we will not discuss any activities of other forces, of other units which will take part in the periphery of the airport. We'll only focus and concentrate on what we have to do in the terminal of the hostages. And that's it. He just told each one of us what's the specific role of each squad. It was a very frightening moment when you are told that you are supposed to be one of the 2 or 3 leading squads.
In Entebbe, Sarah Davidson recalls what it was like for her and her fellow hostages.
In a situation like this, you hold on each hope that you can. And even we didn't trust Idi Amin, but you just hold this hope, you know.
For Nili Ben-Dor, it was almost too much to bear.
Every few hours they say that the time is, the deadline is over and they are going to execute us, each and every one of us, hour by hour. And I remember that my thought was I would like to be one of the first, because I couldn't think seeing the others being killed.
The only thing was to keep quiet and to hope and to pray.
Sarah's prayers would soon be answered. Four Hercules planes were racing towards the hostages. The lead pilot, Joshua Shaney, understood the gravity of the mission.
What bothered me most of the flight was the responsibility they put on my shoulder. The responsibility to make it happen. The fact that this operation like this is like the whole country is behind it, the whole government, the whole people. If you fail in an operation like this, it's a national disaster.
In the next episode, the raid on Entebbe.
As I mentioned, we kept radio silence because we didn't want anybody from the enemy countries next to us to listen.
I loaded my AK-47 and I opened the safety pin, and my friend who was sitting beside me shouted at me, "You are not supposed to open your safety pin to load the weapon within a plane." I told him, "Shut up, this is the real war." When you think that you are 29 against, let's say, 1,000, and the goal of the mission is not to kill the terrorists, but to prevent them from killing someone else, which can be done within a second, it's a crazy operation.
Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had editing help by David Markowitz, with additional production from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabangwa and Damian Thorpe. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.